Good evening. My name is Randy Tomlinson, and I'm here to help you get started in a real adventure this summer. I understand you're going to engage in a series of studies on minor prophets, one of the probably less explored regions of the whole Bible. And I want you to know that you are in for an adventure. I hope you can make the most of this opportunity. And I'm going to do my best to help you tonight by setting up a way of thinking about these minor prophets. I want to show you a big picture approach that will let you then attend maybe more fully to the particulars of each particular book when they are studied in the coming weeks. So tonight I'm only mentioning three verses from the minor prophets themselves, as I didn't want to step on the toes of people who are to come. So I'm going to do my work outside the minor prophets to point you toward them. I know that sounds weird, but just trust me. See if we can figure this out. Because the goal really is to develop some tools in our heads that allow us to access this array of books called the minor prophets, so that the minor prophets can become tools for our thinking, so that we can then go forth and live well before God. Now, of course, we're already doing our best to live well before God, and this is just another set of tools. I guess I'm not a right-eared preacher, so I'm going to have to work on this a bit. In one sense, what I'm asking you to do is to join me in learning how to see. Now, obviously, you already know that, but I hope you also understand that the Bible is full of stories about people learning how to see properly. And so perhaps tonight we can at least make some of the first forays in trying to see into these books called the Minor Prophets. Now, I must confess that some of what I'm going to present, I've already presented to you before, 2 years ago. But I trust that your powers of forgetting rival my own, and it won't hurt to refresh you with some of these things, because then I spoke some about a particular place that I think provides us with an astonishing, useful tool, not just for the minor prophets, but for all the prophets. Because finally, it seems to me that there is a central prophetic task. Major prophets, minor prophets, they all have a similar purpose. And we're just trying to see what that is and see what we can take from that to learn about God's plans more fully. So, tools here, lenses for seeing. The first place I want you to turn with me is Ezekiel chapter 16. Now, this is the part I've talked about before, but deal with it. I want to look at this because it's such an astonishingly, well, at least part of the chapter is an astonishingly compressed model of God's work with people. So let's begin with verse 2. Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations and say, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. That sounds almost like calling names there. Your mother's a Hittite. And as for your birth, on the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to cleanse you, nor rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling clothes. No, I pitied you to do any of these things to you out of compassion for you, but you were cast out on the open field, for you were abhorred on the day that you were born. Can you imagine a more striking picture of rejection and helplessness than that? Well, the writer doesn't stop. God, speaking through Ezekiel, continues on in verse 6. And when I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood. Newborn infant cast out, uncut navel, wallowing in its own blood. That is abject helplessness. And so I want to use this. I want you to remember this is our starting point. We start with that kind of complete helplessness. And so we have this diagram. This is what I've shown you. This is what seems to me so useful as a tool. And some people in this room may have heard it when they were in junior high, and it's coming back to haunt them again. But you can't, and I hope you find it helpful. Because if I'm right, see, when you take any minor prophet, actually any major prophet, you can ask yourself, given the verse that I'm now reading, the passage I'm now reading, where am I on this little diagram? It becomes a tool for orienting your thinking about a passage. And so here we begin with this, we begin with this lowest point of helplessness. Right? But that's not where the story ends. Look what follows in the diagram. There's this strong upward stroke. And look at where we left off. Verse 6, when I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood, I saw you in your helplessness. I said to you in your blood, live. I said to you in your blood, live. I made you flourish. You see what's happened? You see the movement that's being made here? Skip down to verse 8. When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became mine. Do you understand? Here, helpless, and then I made a vow. I entered a covenant with you. And now where do we find ourselves? Here, at the top, chosen. Not because of what I did, but I saw you and I chose you, says God. I did this, he said. I did it. And I spread the corner of my garment. Those of you who want to read elsewhere, that language is used in Ruth. When Boaz spreads the corner of his garment over Ruth on the threshing floor. And Jesus at one point talks about covering, oh Jerusalem, how like a hen that tries to cover her chicks with her wings. This is a God gesture, this covering. And here God has said, I'm covering you, I made you mine, I entered into a covenant, you are chosen. That is a picture of exaltation. You don't see that upward stroke that often in the Bible. That's more often assumed. Most of the prophets, most of the time, are working on these next two strokes. And that's what I'm trying to get you to see. This becomes a tool. This is not something just to notice and say, okay, he showed us a weird diagram. It becomes a tool for thinking. Now I can ask myself, and that's what we'll do with our three verses. Once we've developed our two tools, I'm going to take you to three places and just show you how we can grab hold of just the very smallest bits of the minor prophets, and we can ask ourselves, where do we fit? How does this diagram orient us in our thinking? So let's go next. We'll jump down to verse 38 with me. In verse 38, we're going to see this pretty harsh language. I will judge you as women who commit adultery and shed blood are judged, and bring upon you the blood of wrath and jealousy. Early on, blood was a sign of helplessness, but now blood of wrath, and I will judge you. So now we see where we are in our third diagram, our third point, but it's the second stroke of the diagram. So we've got this, I will judge you in the blood of wrath. And so now we can see this. There's this downward thrust that leads to this fallen state. Right, I judge you, you who were chosen, you who were exalted by my efforts. You were helpless, But I chose you. I entered into a covenant. I made you mine. I adorned you, and you were beautiful. You were mine. But, verse 15, you trusted in your beauty, and you plummeted. And now I will judge you. You are fallen, Israel. Right? And I won't put anybody on the spot to remember the P to the fourth power, the pitiful, perishing pit people. Remember it. Quiz you later. The people here are, they are the pitiful, perishing pit people. The pit is just a metaphor for here, for this collapsed condition, this judged condition, this fallen condition, the blood of wrath. See, so in their first helpless condition, wallowing in your own blood. And now another vision of blood, the blood of wrath. Now, I want you to know, major prophets, minor prophets spend a lot of time talking about that downstroke. You people are downward. You people are plummeting toward the pit. You people are at least flirting with being the pitiful, perishing pit people. Do something about it. And yet, as you know, the story doesn't end there. We have another stroke in the diagram. And notice, but here again, this is meant to be a handy visual. When I was here before, if you look at it just right, it reminds me of my Zorro Z. In a great year of 1958 or so, I got my Zorro set. I had a cape, I had a hat, I had a mask, I had it. But I had the sword. And not just any sword, it was a sword with chalk in the end of it. And I could go around to walls, sisters, and I could put Z's on things. And so this, in some way, that you could just see this kind of a leaning Z. If it doesn't help you, think about something else. But I want you to know that there is this this third stroke, which creates a fourth point. Right? And so let's find some language in the text. If you jump ahead, we're still in the same chapter. You'll notice I am skipping over places I have gleaned from this chapter. Now, you're welcome to fill in the gaps, and I assure you what you can find in those gaps. You can ask yourself, where are we? Well, I suggest it's predominantly language of the pit, language of judgment, language of condemnation, because of the conduct of these people. But when you go to verse 62, let's see what we find. Verse 62. Well, I'm going to back up to verse 60, please. Join me in verse 60. Yet, that's Butt's cousin, a turning word. I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth. See? Remember that first stroke up was the covenant-making one. You were helpless, and I made a covenant with you, and you were chosen. So I don't think you can really get a sense of the minor prophets, unless you understand this language of God as a covenant maker. Maybe we'll come back to that in the last part. You can't really grasp the major prophets either. Verse 60, yet I will remember my covenant with you. And then he goes on, and I will establish for you an everlasting covenant. And then we go on to verse 62, I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall know that I am the Lord. So three times here, very near the end of the chapter, we have this robust assertion by God, I am going to establish a covenant. The first time, it was God's work. You were helpless. I did something. Now you're helpless, pitiful, perishing pit people, and I'm not leaving you in the pit. I am going to summon you from the pit. And then you will be, I've left out one last thing here, verse 63, that you may remember and be comforted and never open your mouth again because of your shame when I atone for you for all that you've done, declares, I will atone for you. And now that brings us to this condition. We're almost at the end of this diagram. Helpless, then chosen, then fallen, then restored. In fact, not only is there a P to the fourth, there's an R to the fourth. You ready? Let's review. P to the fourth, perishing, pitiful, pit people. Now, It is the righteous, repentant, restored remnant. All right, if you don't understand the word, that language of remnant, I want you to know, I just got to partake of a mighty fine casserole, College Station casserole. And I want you to know, when it was over, there was a remnant left in that pan. I was eyeing it. You don't understand the word remnant. And the story of God's plan for his people is the story of a remnant. Not everybody's in the pit, perishing pitifully. There are those who become part of the righteous, repentant, restored remnant. And that's the language here. Now, I think one of the most helpful parts is to understand, well, what is it, if we're chosen by God, what is it that causes me to plummet? What is it? And here we're going to see that, I'm going to click through here and just remind you of the verses. Helplessness is in these first verses. Chosen is there. Fallen, verse 38. Restored, verses 62, 63, in that neighborhood. But here, there are two things that get you in the pit. Old Testament's full of it. Everywhere through there. New Testament, too. Right? 1 John doesn't really seem to talk about it throughout the whole letter. But at the very end, what does he say? Keep yourselves from idols. It is idolatry that gets you in the pit. Today, then. So if you want to think about, what we can do is let the minor prophets, a consideration of the minor prophets give us a chance to rehearse the, this is a fancy Wednesday night word, the ubiquitousness of idolatry. The temptation is there always. And we may think that modern people, we're not statue worshipers. That's where we get caught. Our idolatry may be of a different kind, but nonetheless, real. Secondly, injustice gets you in the pit. I promise you, you cannot read anywhere in the prophets without repeated attention to the desire for justice and the condemnation of injustice. And that resonates in our time in odd ways, perverse ways. But that does not mean that God's not interested in the right justice. And let me just give you one hint. This is something you'll see. One place to look is Isaiah chapter 1. Then you go to Amos chapter 5 and you see something very similar. But repeatedly, test cases for injustice. How do you people take care of widows and orphans? The prophets just come back to that again and again and again. And then think about James chapter 1 in the New Testament. What is true religion in the sight of God? You remember, near the end of that chapter, what is true religion but to visit widows and orphans in their distress and to keep oneself untainted, unstained, unspotted by the world, right? So we're not talking about something peculiar to the minor prophets. We're talking about something that is God's measure all the time. God's righteousness requires justice, and he will have it. Some of it may not happen when we want it to, but that's part of, it seems to me, God's plan. Okay, one part I haven't mentioned, I'll add it in at another moment. This is our first tool then. I really believe that you can ask yourself with any verse, in any minor prophet, where am I in this diagram? That doesn't give you the answers. It just gives you a way to open your thinking. And then you start looking at the particularity. You see, I'm not talking about any historical setting for any prophet. I'm suggesting to you that there's a pattern that cuts across all the prophets and even the New Testament, because it is God's pattern. It is God's plan. So, one tool down. One lens down, and now I take you to a verse And it's a verse in Proverbs that has caught my attention repeatedly for a number of years now. And in fact, I've had to be careful in my thinking about this, because it's easy to kind of tidy it up and use it in its general self-help stuff. Where there's no vision, the people cast off restraint. That's good mission statement talk for any business. But the verse actually says, where there's no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint. All right, to me, that's and blessed is he who keeps the commandments, right? You see, there's an astonishing celebration of, at the end there, law-keeping is said to be a good thing. But notice the problem that has come. The problem is a failure of restraint. Come on. We've got some people that know about school here. On any given night, you have a chance to work on school or to hang with the homies, to go somewhere and do something. And obviously it's not wrong to do that sometime, but if somebody has found out by experience that there's a limit of how much you can do that. You have to, at some point, you have to restrain yourself. According to this verse, the absence of a prophetic vision inhibits restraint. And so I conclude from that, the presence of a prophetic vision invites restraint. If we go back to our diagram, do you really see yourself as the called of God, the chosen of God? I am the covenant partner of the Lord God of the universe. He found me wallowing in my blood, and he chose me and entered into a covenant with me. Blessed am I among people. That's the way it could be, but that's not what happened. But then, it's also possible to have another vision. We'll look at that in just a moment. So here is the language of the whole verse here. Where there is no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint. But blessed is he, beatitude here. Blessed is he who keeps the law. Celebration of law keeping. Not a running away from law, but a running toward it, an eager embrace of law. Because, well, here at least in part, because it's prompted by a prophetic vision. So let's think about this. The goal then is to cultivate a vision that restrains. And so one of the things that I invite you to consider as you look across these minor prophets, what are the different visions that are held before the people? And there are several. Probably my list is not exhaustive, but it's at least a good starting place to see. Here we find people who are being challenged. They're being summoned by prophets. They're being offered visions by prophets in order to prompt restraint on people's parts. So here's our goal. Or here, I give you four visions that seem to me recurring enough that it's worth noting these. A vision of that day, a vision of God's faithfulness, a vision of God's righteousness, and a vision of God's restored remnant. Right? I think you're going to see those again and again and again, and I invite you to look for others. But in each case, what you're finding, if you find a different vision, then you've found Proverbs 29 being fulfilled once more. A prophet who's calling out to people, summoning them to restraint, summoning them to fulfill a vision. As I could just as well have put up here the vision of covenant partnership. Let me mention how this plays out. Some of you know this. At least you would have heard it in East Texas in 1962. I just made that up. Somewhere, somebody's heard this from a parent as you were leaving the house to go somewhere. Come on now, remember who you are. Come on, I'm not asking for a show of hands, but if you're old enough, you probably heard that. And of course, what was meant by that is, and that may not have anything at all to do with religion, it might, but it really has something to do with family identity. Our name means something in this community. When you leave this house, you wear our name. And I want you to have a vision of that before you do something stupid. You understand that? That's a vision that restrains you. I could have done something really weird. If only I had remembered that before we fired the bottle rocket at the police car, I might have been better off. But no, at that moment I was overwhelmed by that urge. It just has to be done. I have the bottle rocket, that car is there, it needs to be done. Come on, you understand that. When you have a vision, I'm somebody, I don't do this. What are the prophets doing? Calling people to vision. Not all of them are, in some ways, we'd like them always maybe, to be exalted, uplifted visions. But sometimes it's not. Look at the first one. I want you to know that there is a vision of that day. And where does that go on our diagram? That's the one I told you I'd mentioned. That's that upward stroke. Because the day of the Lord, that day, there is a day coming. The days are coming. The day of the Lord is coming. Again and again and again across the minor prophets, you're going to find that language. You understand, live, restrain yourself because that day is coming. Live like you know that day is coming. Now, in fact, in Malachi, you'll see this. You think you want the day of the Lord to come? Don't you understand? The day of the Lord has two sides to it. For some people, it will be the day of yea. It will be the day of the righteous, repentant, restored remnant. But that same day will be the day of the pitiful, perishing pit people too. So beware what you ask for. The vision is coming. Understand it. Restrain yourself. Guide yourself by it. Secondly, this is something that's kind of loomed larger in my thinking in recent years. When we talk about having faith, we can wrestle with that language. But really, one way we mean that is we actually believe that God is the one who's faithful. Right? So our faith is in the faithfulness of God. And that's the vision I have before me, no matter how weird things get. And you know, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. No matter how weird things get, God's faithfulness will burst forth, will continue on, because that is His nature. I am the God of relationship. I am the God who makes covenants. I am the God who keeps covenant. And so I entered into a covenant with you in Ezekiel 16. But notice at the end, verse 60, I will remember that covenant. And though there is this pitiful, perishing pit interlude, my remnant is going to make it because I want to have a people, a vision of the faithfulness of God. Somewhat related, but a little bit different, but God's righteousness really is more about the order that God's going to establish. In my mind, it's something like the picture at the end of Revelation where we see this, the tree of life yielding its fruit, the river of the water of life flowing from the throne of God. This is a restored order. This is a picture of God doing it right, or us participating in God's doing it right. That's a vision we can have in front of ourselves. Things may get pretty messed up here. Injustice may be pretty overwhelming here. But God is the God of justice and righteousness, and His order will prevail. And so I'm going to look to that. That's going to be the vision that causes me to restrain. I don't have to do something because vengeance is the Lord's. I don't have to do something again. This one of the ways, once we understand this, then we can cultivate the judgment that allows us to understand when is it our time to do something and when is it time for to let God do what he's going to do, right? It's one way to train ourselves, restrain us from presumption, is to have a vision that God's got a right order that's coming. And I'm going to look to that and be restrained by it. And fourthly, there's a people. God says it all through the Bible. First place it comes to mind, Jeremiah 31:33. They will be my people, and I will be their God. End of Revelation. They will be my people, I will be their God. So God has a vision. I have a vision, says God, of a people for me, my people, for my own possession, a kingdom of priests. I'm going to have my people. It's not everybody, it's a remnant, but they will be my people. And do you understand? Do you understand? God restrains himself because he has that vision. Let us be like God in having this sense that there is a people, and I'm drawn to that. I'm lured by that. I want to restrain myself because I have been given a picture of the vision of God, of God's people. And of course, we understand that in the New Testament, the church is pictured as God's people, right? At least that is God's purpose, God's intention. So when we restrain ourselves, what are we restraining? The two things that get you into the pit: a restraint from idolatry, a restraint from injustice. And so when you're doing that, the alternative is not just resisting the negative, it is we're going to pursue justice, and which is the God's right order part, and then the first one there, we're not going to pursue idolatry, we're going to pursue right devotion to God. You see, that becomes a vision. I'm not just avoiding the bad, I have a vision of the good and I am pursuing it. That's my goal. All right, now, do you understand how you could walk out of this building this evening and carry these with you and say, how can I face the new day with a kind of a braced purpose? Well, I can do that by working the vision into my thoughts, rehearsing the vision, talking about the vision, different vision, talking about a particular vision given in a particular minor prophet. I can also go forth from here asking myself, am I properly tying together vision and restraint? Am I keeping those two together? And then, well, now we can move on to our sampling. I told you we'd have three verses from the minor prophets, and I won't say I picked them at random, although I think you could do that, but I think I picked ones that seem especially inviting to me, that seem to give us a chance. So what I'll ask you to do when we look at these, well, just think for a minute, where in the diagram do we see this? And is it talking about, well, is it talking about that downward stroke into the pit, or is it talking about a restored hope, or just where do we locate ourselves? And again, it doesn't give you all the answers. That's why you're having these separate studies coming. But it gives you a way to start your thinking and a way to emphasize taking this on the road, not so that it's not just something that we think about in class. It's a way now the tools I've worked on here become tools for turning the minor prophets into tools that then can help me live better before God. So here they are, three verses, and we'll be done. I've been cued about the bells, so we'll get them all in here. Just we've got plenty of time, I think. The first one, I want to take you to, it's in Hosea chapter 2. And if you're like me, and I readily confess, I'm sure you're going to have speakers that know their way around, but I get lost in these little books at the end. I didn't learn the song, okay. Some of you will get there a lot faster than I can. But I'm in chapter 2, and I certainly invite you to think. When you read Hosea, you might just the opening chapters there, just really astonishing play with this very thing. It's just overwhelming. Powerful language, some of it which gets brought into the New Testament. But here in let me back up to verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. I will allure. Just that one word, allure. Where are we? You see that already we've got started helpless. I'm trying to draw you out of your helplessness, or I'm trying to draw you out of the pit, right? I'm trying to want you. I'm trying to provide you with a vision. But look at the verse. And there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. You understand? I want to write those words somewhere I can remember them. I want to mark this. I want to come back and think. I want to remember that even in the midst of the pit, it's not over. God says, I'm going to make this valley of Achor, and again, you could get somebody that knows about the book to help you understand how the history fits in here. But even without that, I can just look at the language. A door of hope? Come on now. There's not anybody in this room tonight that can't be glad to be reminded that there is a door of hope. And so in my mind, I see this is that last upward stroke. Here we are in the pit, but there is a door. And there is through that door, what do I see? A vision of hope, right? Which could be added to our list. All right, so please keep that in mind. You're going to have that's a long book. You'll have a lot of work to do trying to work through Hosea when your time comes for this book. But in the midst of all of those things, remember this. In the midst of lots of pit picturing, right, there is this too. All right, let's turn next to the 10 syllables. 9 words, 10 syllables. In the book of Amos, chapter 6. Turn to Amos chapter 6. And here again, I used to make junior high students rehearse these lines with me, not putting anybody on the spot. It won't hurt you to review them tonight. Here they are. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. Right? Come on now. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. 2 syllables there at the end, but it's 9 words, 10 syllables. It's right there in the beginning of chapter 6. If you back up to chapter 5, you see a lot about justice there. But here we have these. Look at this. Come on now. This one invites thinking. Where are we? I'm not expecting a response necessarily in this setting, but I do just ask you to think, where are we in our diagram when we get this? First, just look at those 2 words, at ease. Summertime, living's easy, prop your feet up with iced tea. At ease. What could be wrong with being at ease? That's a good thing. That's desirable. We seek that. And yet, look at the first word. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. Woe to those. Do you understand? How does that fit? Come on. You see, that's the language of restraint. So I would say that's either place you're at the top. You think you've got it made. I'm God's covenant partner. He chose me. He made a covenant with me. The very next verse, verse 15 of Ezekiel 16. But you trusted in your beauty. You see, woe unto you. When you think you've got it made, there's the danger of an idolatry slipping in. Right? Nothing wrong with ease, but there is a woe. There is a restraint that needs to be watched. so that you don't become careless. That reminds you of another non-biblical proverb, nothing fails like success. Think about it. If you want to know what it means, talk to me afterwards. All right, we heard the bell. We're down to the last few minutes, and we only have one more to go. We can do this. And now I could not resist. I don't know if we have anyone here tonight, but I heard at least some people, somebody in the Twin Cities congregation was a cowman. Maybe more than one of you own cows. I don't know. But I'm doing this one for you. One of the minor prophets that's really caught my eye and ear and heart, as I read recently, just astonishing book. I envy whoever gets to teach you this one, the book of Malachi. Join me in the last chapter of the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 4. And we're going to end with this. Look at this. It's astonishing language. It's astonishingly weird. Like calves from the stall. I've got a whole sermon called Hightailing It. But I remember in my youth, newborn calves in the spring frolicking, kicking their heels up, tails in the air as they cavort about with one another. And they're simply exuberant in being newborn calves. And if you think this is not limited to them, I'm a school teacher. I've seen children leave. I know what it's like for children to leave school at the end of the day. They're like calves from the stall. I know what it's like to see children leave at the end of the day on Friday. They're like calves from the stall. And I know what it's like to see children leave on the last Friday of the school year. They're like calves from the stall. Do you understand? Do you understand where we are? That's a celebratory gesture. God has called his remnant. And when that day comes, the remnant's going to be there. And do you have a vision for that? Do you have a sense that I could have that kind of giddy physical exuberance? I am a covenant partner with the Lord of the universe. Keep the vision in front of you and let that restrain you. Again, my goal has been to simply introduce this study that I understand you're going to have, and I hope you can find fruit in it, but the work will be yours, and I know you can do it. I'm sure there's another part of the closing, but I want to close with a prayer with you together. Let's join together. Holy God, thank you for your words. Help them be our words. Help us hide your words in our hearts so we might not sin against you. Help us hide your words in our hearts so we can have visions, prophetic visions that give us a sense of your day. Help us be like calves from the stall, picturing that, picturing the prospect of the remnant, singing praises before you. Help us enthrone you on such praises. Help us to practice justice because we understand that is your nature. We want to be like you. Help us to be careful and to restrain ourselves. Help us this summer talk the minor prophets through our hearts and minds and through our company as we work together to make them our tools. Thank you for these good people. Thank you for this good church. Help them be your remnant here. In the name of Jesus. Amen.